Thank you for the introduction and for inviting me to speak. I'm going to be telling you all about a paper I wrote a couple months ago with Patrick Kaden and Ankar Parikar called The Markov Gap for Geometric Reflected Entropy. And what this is about fundamentally is multipartite entanglement in quantum gravity. It's about a diagnostic of multipartite entanglement called the Markov Gap, and how we can interpret it in quantum gravity and what that teaches us about entanglement in gravity. But I'm also going to try to draw lessons from this about multipartite entanglement in general many-body systems. And that's sort of a big thrust of this work, is trying to sort of start with holography and generalize to non-holographic many-body systems. And we'll talk about that as time goes on. Oh, I should also say, please feel free to interrupt me and ask questions at any time. I'll start with a little bit of motivation. I'm going to talk a little bit about bipartite and tripartite entanglement. I know that this is the quantum info group meeting, but I'm not going to assume that everyone spent a lot of time thinking about, what makes entanglement bipartite and multipartite. I'll give a little discussion of that and try to emphasize why this is something we should be thinking about for quantum gravity. And with that in mind, I'll introduce this thing called the reflected entropy, which was recently introduced. It's an entanglement measure that was recently introduced in holography, but has some interesting implications for general quantum systems. So I'll give you a little review of that. And then by studying the reflected entropy, I'll be able to give you our main result, which is a bound on this reflected entropy, whatever that is, maybe you don't know yet, but a bound that's satisfied by holographic states that we can interpret as telling us something about how space-time arises from multipartite entanglement. I'll try to interpret the result for you. I'll give you a sketch of the proof. It's kind of a fun exercise in like two-dimensional Riemannian geometry. I hope it won't be too esoteric. And then I will indicate some ways I'd like to generalize this work and some ways that I think it can be exported out of the holographic context, which is the thing I'm really excited about. Okay, so this is a talk about entanglement in holography, in quantum gravity, which means the thing that we are going to start with, as always, is the Ryu-Takayanagi formula, or its generalization, the quantum extremal surface formula. I'm going to assume that people are at least passingly familiar with this formula, but just as, a very quick review, the whole point of the quantum extremal surface formula is that when we have states in holographic theories that correspond to spacetimes, that correspond to geometric configurations in the bulk, we can compute the entanglement entropy of a subregion in terms of quantities related to a codimension two surface called the quantum extremal surface, which I've written here as QES. So it's an area of this QES over 4G Newton plus some bulk contribution that won't be particularly important for this talk. But the typical sketch we draw, which I've given on the right side of this slide, I've drawn here a time slice of the ADS3 vacuum, and I've looked at a boundary interval A and its complement, which I've labeled B, and I've drawn this surface, which, because we're in three dimensions, is just a curve that I'm calling the quantum extremal surface that separates A from B. Okay, so a lot of effort has gone into understanding these quantum extremal surfaces and studying them and interpreting them. But what I want to emphasize to you is that if we want to understand entanglement in quantum gravity, the quantum extremal surface formula is never going to be enough, right? So I've said Ryu-Takayanagi is not enough. And the reason for that is that the von Neumann entropy is a bipartite entanglement measure. If I want to look at the entanglement entropy of a subregion in a pure state, that's a function only of a bipartition. It's only sensitive to a region A and its complement. So it can't tell us anything about multipartite entanglement. And the kind of question I want to understand about multipartite entanglement is one I've sort of very, impressionistically cartooned here, is the quantum extremal surface formula tells me something about how A is entangled with its complement. But if I split the complement into regions B1 and B2, I don't know anything about how A is entangled with B1 or with B2, right? And we have good reason to believe that understanding entanglement in quantum gravity is really essential to understanding sort of where bulk spacetime arises from some underlying many-body system. So if we want to understand the rich structure of holographic entanglement, we need something more detailed than entanglement entropy. We need something that will tell us about multipartite entanglement. So a few years ago, some people proposed a geometric object that would tell us something about multipartite entanglement. And the philosophy is very simple. You know, previously we were looking at bipartitions and a natural geometric object associated with a bipartition, which was some surface that cuts the spacetime in two. So if we want to study tripartite entanglement in holography, a good thing to start with would be to say, well, let's look at tripartitions of the boundary state and try to find some simple geometric object associated with a tripartition, okay? And then let's try to figure out if it has an entanglement interpretation, right? So there was this simple geometric object proposed a few years ago by two groups of authors simultaneously called the entanglement wedge cross-section. And in lieu of giving you a formal definition, I'm just gonna sort of explain what it is by example. This is once more a time slice of the ADS3 vacuum. So this is just a disk with the hyperbolic geometry on it. And I look at some boundary interval A and some boundary interval B, and then there's their complement, which maybe I would call C, this sort of top interval and bottom interval on the boundary of the circle, okay? So this is a tripartition. And to this, I can associate a geometric quantity as follows. I first look at the minimal surface, the Ryu-Takinagi surface, as it's called, of AB, which will give me these two blue curves here. And then I call the entanglement wedge, as is usual, the region in between A, B, and their quantum extremal surface, the Ryu-Takinagi surface. Okay, so that's sort of this interior region here. And the way I define the entanglement wedge cross-section is as the minimal cut of the entanglement wedge. So that's this red line. You could have imagined that there are other candidate ways of cutting the entanglement wedge. I could have drawn some curve to the left of the red line or to the right of the red line that would still split the entanglement wedge to something corresponding to A and something corresponding to B. But this thing, by virtue of being minimal in that class, is somehow canonically preferred. Okay? So any questions about the definition of this object before I proceed? I'm not going to talk much more about it, and the rest of the talk is about this object. Okay. Yes?
Sorry. Is it plausible that you have a tripartition in which the diagram looked like the Mercedes logo?
Looks like the Mercedes. I don't know what the Mercedes logo looks like. So,
so the three parts, so each part is in contact with the other two parts?
The Peace Love logo also with that.
I see what you mean. So
If I can jump in, I think please. You just let the region on the top of your diagram shrink to zero size, and then the cross-section just hits the asymptotic boundary, right?
That will happen.
A and B. Yeah. I think that's what she's looking for.
Does that answer your question, Debbie?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks, Rob. So, great. So we're going to be studying this geometric object, but first we need to sort of motivate what it tells us about entanglement. So these two papers that initially introduced the entanglement wedge cross-section proposed it was dual to something called entanglements of purification. I'm not actually going to talk about the entanglement of purification at all, because that conjecture is, I would say, still not well established. There are sort of, well, there are arguments you can make for it, but there is another proposed entanglement quantity described by this cross-section called reflected entropy, discovered recently, that is much more compelling. And that's what I'm going to be talking about. So reflected entropy had never sort of been discussed in the quantum information literature before. It was a new idea coming from holography. And so I'm going to spend a couple of slides telling you how to define it. So the whole story starts with something called a canonical purification. This is actually kind of an old idea in quantum information theory. Canonical purifications show up in various proofs. They show up in Ullmann's theorem. They show up in certain ways of proving monotonicity of Renyi relative entropies. Maybe you've seen them before. But the basic idea is this. We start with a density matrix rho, and we write out its spectral decomposition. So I write rho is equal to some eigenvalues p against some rank one projectors. And then I define a pure state on two copies of the system by changing this bra into a ket and replacing p with square root p. So that's what shows up here at the bottom of this first box. So you can verify for yourself that this state psi does purify rho. If I trace out the second system, I'm going to get rho back, okay? And it's a very interesting purification. It has sort of seemingly a very complex entanglement structure that we can use to sort of suss out things about the entanglement structure of Rho that wouldn't have been immediately obvious before. I would say actually very little is known about canonical purifications in general. This is sort of an interesting thing to think about. But this process is, I think, very familiar to anyone who spent any time about high energy theory, any time thinking about high energy theory, because it's exactly how you get the thermal field double state from a thermal state. So as an example, if we have a thermal density matrix, which I've drawn here, which in holography we think about representing a one-sided black hole, the exterior of a black hole, then when we canonically purify, we get this state that people love to call the thermofield double, and which is supposed to represent two entangled black holes, or two black hole exteriors entangled to be a single sort of eternal black hole with two asymptotic regions. So the motivation for what's about to happen comes from this thermofield double. We say, well, in holography, we started with a black hole, and how did we get its canonical purification? We took two copies of the black hole, and we glued them together along the horizon, right? That's how you get the thermofield double from a one-sided black hole, from a black hole exterior. So what Dutta and Faulkner argued in this very beautiful paper using the gravitational path integral is that that same process is how you get a canonical purification of any holographic state. So you take a holographic state. So you have some, you know, region in a CFT that has a density matrix that corresponds to a bulk region. And this has some, that bulk region has some spatial boundary. So what you're told to do is to take two copies of that bulk region and glue them together along the spatial boundary, just like you take two black holes and glue them together on the bifurcation surface. So I've sketched that here. We have on the left a domain of dependence on the boundary of ADS3. Where there lives a density matrix rho that has some bulk entanglement wedge dual to it. That's this sort of bulk wedge that I've drawn here. And what Dutta and Faulkner tell us to do is we take two copies of that. Technically, we have to CPT conjugate one, but I wouldn't worry too much about that. And then we glue the two copies together. And we end up with some initial data that we can evolve to create a full spacetime. Okay. So once we know that this is what we do to create a canonical purification, we can start using canonical purifications to look at bipartite states in quantum gravity. So let's look back at our favorite tripartition, our favorite, you know, AB system state, which is two intervals in the vacuum of ADS3. And I've resketched this on the left. You remember it from before. A and B are intervals. Their entanglement wedge is this connected region, and sigma is the entanglement wedge cross section. So what Dutta and Faulkner tell us to do to construct the canonical purification is to take this middle region, double it, and glue it to itself, glue the two copies together along the blue surfaces. So that's what I've drawn on the right. The top half and the bottom half of this figure are both copies of the entanglement wedge on the left, and they've been glued together on the blue surface. And you should think that the top and bottom of this picture are glued together as well. Okay? So something very interesting happens, which is that now that we have this spacetime, we can apply the Ryutake-Inagi formula to the AA prime system in the canonical purification. And when we do that, the corresponding surface is going to be this red line. And I don't think it should be too hard to convince yourself that that red line is just twice the entanglement wedge cross section. Okay? So what we find is that the entropy of the AA prime subsystem in the canonical purification goes like twice the entropy of the entanglement wedge cross section. Okay? So this is sort of the reason that Dutta and Faulkner started thinking about these canonical purifications, because they wanted an entanglement quantity that would tell them about entanglement wedge cross sections. And that's what we have. It's called the reflected entropy. And you define it for a bipartite state by canonically purifying and looking at the von Neumann entropy in the AA prime system. Benny, do you have a question? Oh, okay.
I may have a question. So in the first example, you showed like with one region, is it, how should I think of maybe the previous slide? Oh, I think.
Yeah, great.
Before. Is it the new geometry, how should I interpret it, or should I interpret
yes.
it? Or?
So if you want to think about time slices, which might be easier, this thing on the left, I've drawn a fully covariant picture, but you could just think of this as, you know, well, here, let me look back at this picture. You could just think of the entanglement wedge as being the region below the quantum extremal surface in this picture,
mm-hmm.
right? And if I double that and sew them together, mm-hmm. I'm going to get another hyperbolic disk.
Right, so this sewing together procedure, is there something I can always do?
Or yeah, it's something you can, well, you have to be a little careful. Mm-hmm, these, mm-hmm. if you have no quantum matter, it's very simple because mm-hmm. these surfaces are always locally minimal.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you know, their extrinsic curvature, the trace of their extrinsic curvature vanishes, and you can mm-hmm. show that that's enough to be able to smoothly glue them together.
I see. So is there any like a natural Hamiltonian associated for, is it like, should I just use modular Hamiltonian as the Hamiltonian for the new geometry, or is there any arising notion of Hamiltonian or
the question about
wave function or?
Yeah, so it's very easy to think about from the bulk picture in that you just take two geometries and you sew them together, and then you have initial data. Mm-hmm. And you use the usual reflecting boundary conditions on ADS, and that tells you how to evolve your initial data to get a full spacetime.
Okay.
If you want to ask more subtle questions, like what are the modular Hamiltonians of these states, I think that's actually probably like an interesting and subtle question that we don't fully understand.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So this quantity, which I'll call SR, the reflected entropy, as I said, is defined as the AA prime entropy of the canonical purification. And what Dutta and Faulkner have told us is that this is equal to the area of the entanglement wedge cross-section over 2 gNewton. Usually we have a 4, but there was that factor of 2 coming from the doubling in the canonical purification. And then there's some quantum corrections, which we won't worry about at all in this talk. But what I'm going to be talking about is studying this area to try to learn something about the reflected entropy and vice versa. You know, now that we have a duality, we can start playing this beautiful game of doing some quantum info work on the reflected entropy, doing some bulk work on the entanglement wedge cross-section and trying to understand how these two things influence each other. So I'll tell you a few fundamental properties of the reflected entropy. This first bullet point, I'm just flashing for the quantum info experts in the audience. I won't really talk about it very much, but there's a relationship between reflected entropy and mutual information. And if you need a refresher on how mutual information is defined, I've put that in a footnote down here. Reflected entropy minus mutual information can be written as a conditional mutual information on the canonical purification. Don't worry too much if you don't know off the top of your head what a conditional mutual information is. I'm not going to talk about it during this talk, but I will tell you that in the paper itself, we have a pretty big section where we try to study the quantum information theoretic interpretation of reflected entropy minus mutual information using the fact that it can be written as a conditional mutual information. For the purposes of this talk, all that really matters is that conditional mutual informations are non-negative. This is what people usually call the strong subadditivity inequality. So this tells us that SR minus I is a non-negative quantity. I'm going to introduce some terminology and I'm going to call SR minus I the Markov gap. That terminology comes from this conditional mutual information. There's terminology in quantum info literature that states with zero conditional mutual information are called Markov states. So we're talking about, you know, the non-zero conditional mutual information here being a Markov gap. But again, for the purposes of this talk, that's just terminology. Don't worry too much about the information theoretic implications. I do have some supplemental slides at the end that I can use to talk about that if anyone's curious during question and answer. So the last property of reflected entropy I need to share, or of the Markov gap, that is sort of the whole impetus for this work, is that Chris Akers and Pratik Rath wrote a very interesting paper in which they showed, well, let me talk about orders for a moment. I'll remind you that in holography, we're always working in a limit where Newton's constant becomes very small. So we can talk about the size of quantities parametrically. We can talk about what order they are in that quantity. And Chris and Pratik showed that if a holographic state has a non-zero Markov gap at leading order, so leading order is order 1 over Newton's constant, then it must also have multipartite entanglement at that order. So in that sense, the Markov gap is a witness for parametrically large multipartite entanglement. I'm not going to explain the result at all. I ask you to take it on faith, because a lot of what we're going to be doing going forward is trying to understand, you know, under what circumstances in the bulk does the Markov gap become large, become order one over genu. Okay. So that's it for introduction and motivation.
So just for clarification, yeah. So multipartite entanglement is like is the original wave function, like this A, yeah. B, and C is not in the...
That's right, A, B, and C. Okay. So the way they prove it is they write a state that has, they write a state that is entirely bipartite. You know, there's some bipartite entanglement between AB, between BC, and between AC. And then they add some small, you know, extra system that can be entangled whoever you want, but whose dimension is parametrically small. Mm-hmm. And then they show that the Markov gap has to be parametrically small in that case as well.
All right.
Okay. So, great. So now I'll tell you about our paper. That was all motivation and introduction. So there's a technical result, which I will state and then try to explain and interpret and then sketch the proof of. So we're looking at a particular holographic theory, which is pure ADS3 quantum gravity. So what that means is we have quantum gravity with a negative cosmological constant. So our solutions are asymptotically anti-de Sitter. We're working in three dimensions, and we're not going to add any matter. There's still a lot of degrees of freedom in this system. You know, we have all of the gravitational degrees of freedom. But we're not going to add any matter. It makes things complicated. That would be an interesting direction to generalize, but that's still to be done. Also, everything I'm going to talk about assumes that we are working with time-symmetric states, but I think actually the proof technique I'm going to explain generalizes to non-time-symmetric states. We just didn't work out the details. So here's the inequality. For any such state, the Markov gap is lower bounded by some universal constant, which is log 2 over 2 g newton, times the size of the cross-section boundary, right? So this is the cardinality of the cross-section boundary. Remember, the cross-section is some one-dimensional curve with endpoints. So this number just counts the number of those endpoints. I'll give you some examples. If you look on the left of this slide, you'll see our favorite bipartite state again, two intervals in the vacuum. And in this case, the entanglement wedge cross-section has two endpoints, right? So that number in this inequality would be 2. And the total inequality would tell us that SR minus I has to be bigger than or equal to log 2 over genu n. Okay. Another pretty classic example to think about is a geometry corresponding to a three-boundary wormhole. So this thing on the right is it's a hyperbolic manifold with three asymptotic boundaries at A, B, and C. Sometimes you'd call it a pair of pants geometry. And I'm considering A and B to be my bipartite state. I'm looking at their Ryu-Takinagi surface, which is up here. It's the throat of the C mouth of the wormhole. And the entanglement wedge cross-section is going to be some curve that starts on the front of the wormhole, goes down around the back of the wormhole, and ends up on the other side. Okay. And once more, this has two endpoints, so that number is going to be 2. But I'll stress that you can construct manifolds, you can construct states where you have an arbitrary number of endpoints to the entanglement wedge cross-section. You know, each component can only have 1 or 2 endpoints, but you can have arbitrary numbers of components to the entanglement wedge cross-section, and you'll end up with arbitrary numbers of endpoints. So this inequality is actually quite restrictive. It tells us that the more endpoints we have, and this is essentially just some topological counting of a manifold, the more of this Markov gap we need to have. Okay. So the way we want to interpret this, and this isn't completely watertight, but I think it's good intuition, is that because Chris and Pratik showed that this Markov gap is parametrically large only if you have significant tripartite entanglement, we want to take this formula to suggest that these bulk geometric features, these endpoints of the entanglement wedge cross-section, emerge from irreducible tripartite entanglement. Now, the reason I say irreducible tripartite entanglement is because you'll notice this inequality is an inequality, right? The Markov gap can generically be much bigger than log 2 over 2 g newton times this integer, but it can never be any smaller. So I want to think of each of those boundaries in the entanglement wedge cross-section as contributing some irreducible tripartite entanglement, something you can't get rid of no matter how hard you try. Okay? So that's sort of the motivation here. That's why we're interested in proving this inequality. It's telling us something about how bulk features emerge from multipartite entanglement features. I think it would be good before I jump into the proof just to say, I'd love to generalize this to states with matter or to higher dimensions. I think it would help us better understand universal tripartite entanglement in quantum gravity. But I also think that we can export some of this to non-holographic many-body systems. I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. And I'd be very interested in looking at higher dimensions in the gravity system to see, you know, what we might want to try to export. Okay, so,
can I
ask, Benny.
Question. So when I studied tensor network, like toy models, then study like multipartite entanglement, mm-hmm. what I usually find is like, if I split the boundary into 3, 4, 5 regions, mm-hmm. then I draw each RT surface, then there's usually a region in the middle, mm-hmm. like a big region. It's actually not big because it's in the bulk, but usually I tend to find a few random tensors or perfect tensor or whatever living on this tiny region. And what I found is this tensors, these few tensors living on this tiny volume, bulk is responsible for multipartite entanglement.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, is this something? Yeah, I don't know. Is it related or?
So there's a connection I can tell you about, which is, this is not my work, but there's some ongoing work by. I'm going to miss all the authors. I think Tom Faulkner, Chris Akers, Pratik Rath, and one of Tom Faulkner's students, Simon, I think is his name, where they're studying this Markov gap in random tensors, in random tensor mm-hmm. networks. And they find that these random tensor networks do display non-trivial Markov gaps. That paper isn't out yet. I don't know very much about it, so I can't tell you exactly what they've discovered, but I think there is a connection.
I see. Because I found that this volume in the middle is actually can be computed, and because of that, I keep forgetting the name of the. It's just a very simple theorem about areas, but I just thought that it's maybe related.
Yeah, there is an interesting, especially something I'll comment on is that stabilizer tensor networks don't have multipartite entanglement, but general random tensor networks do. That's sort of interesting.
The stabilizers, you mean tripartite or?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
This is a result of Sepper Nizami and Michael Walter.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
So let's try to prove this inequality.
Can I just ask a possible question?
Please, go ahead.
Is this inequality, do you know of instances where it's tight, particularly for, having more than two points on the boundary?
Yeah, so generally what's going to happen, this isn't always going to be the case, but generally what happens is that this inequality becomes saturated when you take the separations between all of your intervals to be very small. Okay, so you're looking at sort of a high entanglement limit in some sense. That's maybe not the right way to say it, because the mutual information is getting very large in that case. But when you're looking at a quantum field theory state, right? When you take the separation between A and B to be very, very small, you're going to tend to approach this limit. And actually, I'll talk a lot more about that at the end of the talk, because that's the feature that I think is universal in other quantum field theories. Okay.
May I ask one more question?
Yes.
This is holographic result, but is there anything known about this quantity for the general quantum systems like CFD?
I'll talk about that at the end. Is that okay? Okay? I have a couple slides on it at the end. Okay, so let me convince you that we actually did something. Let me explain to you how this proof works. So we're going to spend a lot of time thinking about our favorite example two-party state, just because it's easy to draw, but everything I'm going to say works very generally. So the idea is the following. The Markov gap can be expressed as, let's think about the areas that contribute to the Markov gap. There's twice the area of the entanglement wedge cross-section. That comes from the reflected entropy. So that's two copies of this entanglement wedge cross-section here. We have to subtract off the areas of the RT surfaces of A and B. Those come from minus the mutual information. And then we have to add in the RT surfaces of AB, right? That's also from minus the mutual information, right? So what we have to do is we have to add in the red surface twice, subtract off this left surface, subtract off this right surface, and add back in the top and bottom surfaces. And we can rewrite, we can sort of regroup the terms in that addition and subtraction in a very suggestive way. And I've done that on the right. What we want to do is we want to add in part of RTAB, one copy of the entanglement wedge cross-section, and then part of RTAB, that's this first surface on the left here, and then subtract off one of the RT surfaces, the RT surface for A, and then do the same thing symmetrically for B, right? This way of writing the Markov gap has exactly the same content. I'm adding and subtracting the same areas, but something very interesting has happened, which is that I've combined all of my areas to create these two new surfaces, these two purple surfaces, right? This first purple surface is homologous to the A region. And what that means is that when I'm defining the RT surface of the A region, this purple surface is one of the candidate surfaces I have to minimize over, right? The RT prescription tells you minimize over all surfaces in a certain homology class. This purple surface is in that homology class. And that tells me that the blue surface, because it's defined to be minimal in that homology class, has to have smaller area, right? So this first subtraction and this second subtraction are individually non-negative. Okay, that's good because we know that the Markov gap is non-negative, right? This is a way of seeing that from the bulk perspective. But we can do better. That's sort of the whole point of this talk, is that we can lower bound these area differences in terms of the number of kinks in this purple surface, okay? And that's going to be where we get our bound from. So I'm going to call these kinds of purple surfaces KRT surfaces. That stands for kinked Ryutaki Inagi. Okay, that's why the title of this slide is RT and KRT surfaces. And we're going to reduce what we're asking now to a geometric question. We want to lower bound the area difference between KRT and RT in terms of the number of kinks. So let me reframe this question for you. We're going to ask a question about Riemannian geometry on hyperbolic two-dimensional manifolds. So we have two-dimensional Riemannian manifolds with a hyperbolic metric. Okay, the reason we're allowed to restrict to this is because I'm considering time symmetric states. So I can always look at a time slice, which is going to be a hyperbolic manifold in ADS3. Like I said, I think you can generalize this to three dimensions, but you need to be a little careful. So the question is, on a hyperbolic two manifold, if KRT is a geodesic with right angled kinks and RT is the minimal homologous geodesic, can we show that the area difference is lower bounded by log two times the number of kinks? You'll check if you look at the relationship between the number of kinks in the KRT surfaces and the number of endpoints in the entanglement wedge cross-section, that this is exactly the inequality you want to give you the inequality I claimed earlier, right? Each endpoint of the entanglement wedge cross-section sort of, you know, pair produces one kink in each KRT surface, is how I like to think about it, okay? So we want to prove this. And the way we're going to do it is using a beautiful sort of bound on the geometry of right-angled pentagons in hyperbolic space. This is just an interesting little detour, I think. So what I've drawn on the left here is the Poincaré disk. That's a disk with a hyperbolic metric. And I've drawn a right-angled pentagon. So this purple region here, its five sides are all geodesics, and they all meet at right angles. Okay, and I've labeled two adjacent sides B and the opposite side C. So there's a bound on these lengths, which is A plus B minus C is bigger than or equal to log two. This follows from hyperbolic trigonometry, basically. There's a law of cosines that relates all of these lengths. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. I think it's sinh A times sinh B equals cosh C. But so there's some constraint between the A's, B's, and the C's from hyperbolic trigonometry. And you minimize over this constrained space, and you find that A plus B minus C is bigger than or equal to log two. If you're curious, the log two comes from the large argument expansion of the Arc-Cosh function. I don't know. That's not very intuitive, but it's where it comes from mathematically. So the reason...
I have a very naive question. Why can't I just shrink everything smaller?
Really small? You won't be able to keep all of the angles to be right angles. Right, so you can't have, in flat space, you can't have a pentagon that has all right angles.
Right.
Right, and if you shrink, you're basically going to a flat space limit. It's just not going to be allowed by curvature.
I see.
Yeah. Another way to say it is if you think about like the Gauss-Binet theorem,
it tells
you what the total integrated curvature has to be in terms of the exterior curvature, right? So you can't make the area too small. That's limited by Gauss-Binet.
Yes. Sure.
Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to use these right-angled pentagons to tile the region between the KRT and RT surfaces. So here's a simple example. Here's the KRT surface from our two intervals example on, you know, sort of the right boundary of this picture. And the blue surface on the left boundary is the RT surface. And we can tile the intermediate region with two right-angled pentagons. Now you might object, these things I've drawn only have four sides. But you can actually realize each of these tiles as a degenerate right-angled pentagon. You imagine that this point at infinity is really a side of zero length. Right, so you could realize this thing as a right-angled pentagon where you take the limit where one of the sides shrinks and goes off to infinity. So that's what one of these quadrilaterals is. Okay, so when I do this tiling, I get a1 plus b1 minus c1 is bigger than or equal to log 2, a2 plus b2 minus c2 is bigger than or equal to log 2, and I have my bound. krt minus rt is bigger than or equal to 2 log 2, and 2 is the number of kinks. So that's what we want to prove. Of course, this is just one special example. We want to prove this very generally. I'm going to give one more example that I think will be sort of instructive, which is if we look again at the three boundary wormhole. The KRT surfaces here are, they're closed surfaces, right? There's one that starts here, goes around the back of the wormhole, loops down and back up the front. So it's like topologically a circle with two kinks in it, right? That's the KRT surface for A. The RT surface for A is this smooth loop. And it turns out, you have to prove this, but it turns out that you can tile the region between KRTA and RTA with two right-angled pentagons. I've drawn the ones on the front here. And notice that these pentagons are not degenerate. Any questions about this picture or about the intuition? Okay. So the main obstacle, so we want to show that this can be done on a general hyperbolic manifold for any sort of kinked geodesic. Right-angle kinked geodesic, right? But there's an issue we have to address, which is that such a tiling can't possibly be done for a higher genus manifold. So for example, look at what I've drawn here. I've drawn some kinked loop. This is supposed to be some like portion of a hyperbolic manifold. There's a kinked loop here, and there's an RT surface, which is like a geodesic loop down here. And between them, there's a topological obstruction. Now, it's not going to be possible for me to make a pentagonal tiling of the one that I described earlier, of the kind that I described earlier. And the reason for that is that if I make a pentagonal tiling, that's like a triangulation, it assigns some Euler character to this manifold, but that Euler character is incompatible with this hole, this topological hole in the manifold, right? So purely on topological grounds, we can see that this will not work, right? And that's only sort of one kind of obstruction. You know, even if there aren't topological obstructions, how do we know that such tilings exist? You know, you can sort of convince yourself if you have any particular metric in mind, but you have to do some work to show that this is possible for any hyperbolic manifold. Okay? So what we're actually going to do is we're going to address both of these obstructions in one swoop. And the way we're going to do it, we're going to use covering space theory and just focus on this first bullet point for now. We're going to show that KRT is homotopic to a smooth geodesic, which I'll call gamma. So if you look back at the previous slide, KRT and RT are homologous. What that means is that they form the boundary of some topological set, right? They form the boundary of this intermediate region, but they're not homotopic. You can't smoothly deform KRT to get RT. So what we're going to show is that you can smoothly deform KRT into some geodesic. So you should think there's going to be some closed geodesic gamma that sits on top of this topological obstruction, right? And what we're going to show is that that homotopy region can be tiled with pentagons. So that's going to tell us that the length difference between KRT and gamma is going to be lower bounded by log 2 times the number of kinks. And then we use a very simple argument. Well, gamma is homotopic to KRT, so it's definitely homologous. Homologous is a weaker equivalence relation, right? Gamma is homologous to KRT. KRT was homologous to RT. So that means gamma is homologous to RT, but RT was assumed to be the minimal surface within its homology class. So we get that the area of RT is less than or equal to the area of gamma, And then we use our pentagonal tiling to get that that's less than or equal to the area of KRT minus log 2 times the number of kinks. And that'll give us the bound we want. Okay. So how do we actually prove that you can do this homotopy? This is actually related to, I ended up reading, while I was trying to prove this, reading some very interesting literature about two-dimensional hyperbolic geometry. And there's this sort of classic theorem that every loop on a hyperbolic manifold is homotopic to a unique geodesic. And so what we end up doing is using that proof, but modifying it to get the additional sort of length change restrictions that we want. So we're going to start with the Poincaré disk. We're going to start with the hyperbolic manifold. And here, we're going to say KRT is any kinked geodesic on the Poincaré disk with well-defined boundary endpoints, right? So KRT is some, you know, geodesic segment, then it kinks, and then there's a geodesic segment, then it kinks, and a geodesic segment, and so on. There could be an infinite number of kinks. All we need is that it limits to some unique point on the boundary, okay? Now, it's a fact about the hyperbolic disk that there is a unique geodesic between any two points on the boundary. So that's what I'm going to call gamma, and I've drawn that here. And I think it's quite obvious that KRT is going to be homotopic to gamma, right? But there's some things we need to check. We need to check that the homotopy region can be tiled by right-angled pentagons. We need to check that KRT and gamma don't intersect. You know, I've drawn this in a very suggestive way, but we need to be a little bit careful. All this is done very carefully in the paper. I'll sketch it very briefly now. What we're going to do is we're going to try to construct a pentagonal tiling of this homotopy region. And we're going to use a fact about hyperbolic geometry, which is that for any two geodesics on the Poincaré disk, there is a unique geodesic intersecting them both at right angles. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at each geodesic segment in the KRT surface and draw the unique perpendicular geodesic connecting it to gamma. And when we do that, we'll construct a pentagonal tiling. I've drawn that here at the bottom, and I think it's sort of fairly obvious that this is what happens. The only thing you need to be careful about is the following. We know that there is a unique geodesic connecting any two geodesics, right? But KRT isn't made up of full geodesics, it's made up of segments. So we want to worry about situations like this, right? Imagine eta j is some segment of the KRT surface. It extends to some full geodesic, and we know that there's some perpendicular connection between that geodesic and gamma, but we might have to worry that that connection happens outside of the segment, right? We might have to worry that because of that, we're not able to make a tiling. So what we do in the paper is that we show that you can't end up with a situation like this unless the KRT surface self-intersects, right? Which is not going to happen for the surfaces we care about, okay? I'm not going to give you the proof of that. I'm only sort of trying to indicate to you what kind of work needs to be done to prove this. Okay, so if you believe everything I've said, then you see that on the Poincaré disk, we can always do one of these pentagonal tilings, and that proves our lemma for the specific case of the Poincaré disk. But then we can use covering space theory, because it's a theorem about hyperbolic manifolds that they are all universally covered by the Poincaré disk. So what this picture in the middle represents, I've used some notation from the paper. KL here stands for kinked loop. We're looking at some kinked loop on a hyperbolic 2 manifold and some point P. And we use that point P to construct some lift of the loop to the universal cover. And what that's going to give us is some asymptotic kinked geodesic in the Poincaré disk. And then you need to check all sorts of things, right? You need to check that that asymptotic geodesic has well-defined boundary endpoints, for example. You need to check that, basically the rest of what you need to check is you need to sort of, you know, you're trying to compute a length difference in the hyperbolic manifold, and you can constrain some length differences in the universal cover. So what you need to do is sort of go back and forth between the covering space and the base space and keep careful track of the lengths and prove that the result that you have for the Poincaré disk implies what you want for any hyperbolic manifold. Okay, that's what we do in the paper. That's all I'm planning on saying about it. But that's the essential way that you argue. Okay, so what do we learn by doing this proof? I think actually the proof technique is quite suggestive. So for one thing, we prove our inequality, which tells us something about tripartite entanglement in holographic states. I've written it in a more sort of suggestive way here. I've done, you know, 2 log 2 times the boundary endpoints, or the cross-section endpoints, because, you know, it's log 2 times the number of kinks, and the number of kinks is 2 times the number of endpoints. But what's interesting about the way that we proved it is that every single one of these endpoints was treated on equal footing. To each endpoint, we associate two right-angled hyperbolic pentagons. There's one for each KRT surface, right? There's one for the KRT surface of A and one for the KRT surface of B. So sort of, and then of course, to each of these pentagons, we associate a minimal area difference of, that should say log two, right? So what we see is that the argument is very symmetric, right? Each of these vertices gives rise to some independent contribution to the Markov gap. And that's aesthetically in line with what we sort of think is true, which is that each point in this boundary of the cross-section contributes some irreducible tripartite entanglement. In the proof, it's suggested by the fact that we, you know, pair produce these two pentagons, which we're thinking of as encoding the irreducible entanglement. Okay. So there are a couple things I think should be done, some things I'm working on now to try to extend this. The first thing is that I'd really like to know whether this inequality holds for spacetimes with matter. Maybe we stick in the classical regime and we look at matter satisfying some suitable energy condition, probably the weak energy condition, right? We could think about spacetimes with quantum matter too, but that's a more considerable task. I'd really like to know whether this bound still holds for spacetimes with matter, because it's going to tell us something about whether, you know, is this a property of gravitational degrees of freedom, right? This is true of certain things, like the monogamy of mutual information is a statement that is true about gravitational degrees of freedom, but not general quantum degrees of freedom, right? We want to understand whether this is a feature of pure gravity or a feature of gravity with matter, but the covering space proof that I've just described to you just won't work for any manifold that is not locally hyperbolic. So we're trying to create a new proof technique. I'm working on this with a fellow grad student, Dan Inakeku. Another thing I'd really like to figure out is whether there's a version of this inequality in higher dimensions. I only talked about three bulk dimensions, two boundary dimensions, right? There are two sort of obvious ways you could imagine generalizing this. Maybe the lower bound is some constant, something that depends on dimension, times the codimension three area of the cross-section boundary. So in three bulk dimensions, the cross-section boundary was just a collection of points. So the area of that set is just its cardinality. Right? But in higher dimensions, say in four bulk dimensions, the cross-section is going to be two-dimensional, so the cross-section boundary will be one-dimensional. And you keep going up like that. And maybe this is going to tell us something about the area of that boundary. It's also possible that maybe it really is just an integer counting. Maybe this thing just counts components of the cross-section boundary. We've done some numerics. We sort of tried to minimize the Markov gap in various families of spacetimes in higher dimensions to look for what this universal constant might be. Unfortunately, we weren't able to find anything. I don't think that means that no such constant exists. It just means that, you know, numerical optimization over a few special families isn't going to help you find it. Okay. The other main thing I'd really like to do, and this answers Benny's question from earlier, is the following. We know that ADS3 gravity is a CFT, or maybe an ensemble of CFTs. This is sort of the new conventional wisdom. But it's a system with a central charge. And that central charge is 3 over 2 genuine. So I'm going to do something sort of provocative, and I'm going to rewrite my inequality in terms of the central charge. This thing on the right sort of makes sense in any two-dimensional conformal field theory. Certainly the C over 3 log 2 does. The integer counting the number of cross-section endpoints doesn't quite. But you could do something like the following. You can say, well, for, you know, two intervals in the vacuum, if my state is holographic, then the number of cross-section endpoints is 2, right? So we can say for two intervals in the vacuum, let's look at 2c over 3 log 2 as a quantity that we might want to pursue in generic CFTs, okay? And the question is basically, you know, are there signatures of this bound in generic two-dimensional conformal field theories and therefore in generic spin systems? And the answer is yes, it seems. So the bound does not hold, right? The bound simply does not hold in arbitrary two-dimensional conformal field theories. But as I indicated earlier, there is a limit in many cases where the bound is saturated. And that's the limit that tends to be the limit where all of the separations between the intervals get very small. And we've done some preliminary numerical searches. And it turns out that it looks like in a generic CFT, you get the same limit. The Markov gap always limits this universal value C over 3 log 2 times an integer whenever you take these separations to be very small, even if your CFT isn't holographic. So it sort of seems like this quantity C log 2 over 3 is some quantum of a certain kind of tripartite entanglement. I think it'd be really good to understand where that comes from in generic spin systems, okay? So I'm working on some stuff right now, trying to use conformal field theory techniques to try to actually prove this, to see where this thing comes from in generic conformal field theories. There's also some—
Is it for like interacting CFTs?
Yeah, I think it should work. Well, so the numerics—
Free CFT, I expect that mostly it's bipartite entanglement, so.
This limit holds in free CFTs as well. But free, you have to remember, you have to remember it's a very particular limit.
Uh-huh.
Right?
I see.
Yeah.
I have one more question. So generically, this inequality, when is it saturated, like geometrically? Like what kind of configuration I should take to—
Yeah, so it's saturated here. Let me just show you. So the bound on the pentagons is saturated when the pentagons become large. So that corresponds to the case when the intervals become very large, and therefore the entanglement wedge cross section becomes very large. This is the limit Rob was talking about earlier, where it goes all the way out to the asymptotic boundary, right?
Oh, I see. So like it approaches to Y.
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
And so one way to think about it is sort of like the entanglement wedge cross section starts to be the thing that dominates the entanglement, and the portions of RTAB become less and less important because those are getting very small. So we want to study the same limit in generic CFTs. And my collaborator Yi-Chion Zhou has done some numerics in a couple of simple CFTs and has found that it actually does look like you get some universal limit, which is interesting. And I'd like to understand this quantity as a quantum of a certain kind of tripartite entanglement. There's some things you can do in CFT using— well, maybe I don't want to say too much about that right now. But I think that this would be an interesting way to try to sort of use a holographically inspired calculation to learn something about the entanglement structure of generic 2D systems, 1+1-dimensional systems. Okay, great. That's all I have to say. Thank you for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, thanks for the great talk. I already asked lots of questions, and actually I need to leave in 3 minutes to pick up my son. So I think I will ask Michael to share the rest, if it's fine.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thanks, John, for the really nice talk. Do you have any more questions? Could we just unmute?
Maybe I could ask a very naive question.
Please.
So are there questions related to multipartite entanglement beyond tripartite that you want to explore? Or?
Yeah, I'd love to. So tripartite is just sort of the, you know, it's already hard, as I'm sure you know. So we're just sort of trying to start there. But I'm very interested— well, you can certainly define generalizations of this geometric structure for arbitrary number of parties. There are— I think a lot of this work was done by Ning Bao and collaborators a few years ago, just defining these geometric generalizations. And then you might want to ask questions like, are there natural entanglement quantities that compute that? And one of sort of the nice things about this is that the gravity side of the story leads you to think about entanglement quantities that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise, such as the reflected entropy. And I think looking at higher party generalizations of that and trying to say, well, do these teach us anything about general spin systems at higher party number is something I'd be very interested in doing.
Thanks.
Tarun, I think you were first with your hand up.
Should I go ahead or?
Yeah.
Thank you. A very nice talk. I had one question about— there's some intuition generally that multipartite entanglement is good for something being a good error correcting code, at least naively, because it's you're hiding information better. Is there any relation between this Markov gap and some property of some error correcting code?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, well, I don't want to make any claims about error correcting codes, but right. So there is this fact about conditional mutual informations. Now, conditional mutual informations are related to what we call Markov recovery processes. This was proved by Fossey and Renner and then generalized by these authors, right? So the statement is that the Markov gap is an upper bound on the following. You start with three parties of the canonical purification. So that's A, B, and B prime. And you ask, if I only had access to the A, B system, and I was only allowed to touch the B system, and I wanted to try to reproduce A, B, B prime, how well could I do that, right? So this is a recovery problem. It's not a codes problem because there's not a subspace, but it is a recovery problem. And if you have a very small Markov gap, then this inequality tells you that there is going to be some recovery channel that does this with very high fidelity. And conversely, if you have some argument that, you know, the fidelity should be quite low, if the multipartite entanglement is sort of sufficiently spread out that the fidelity of this recovery process has to be low, then that's going to tell you that there's a large Markov gap. And there's a section in the paper where we give some geometric interpretation to this.
Thank you. Maybe one other small question. Is there any relation between this Markov web and some other known multipartite? For example, people talk about something tangled. Might have heard of this thing called tangle.
So I admit I don't know very much about this. It seems very interesting. It's in some sense much coarser than that, I think, because any of these like tangles or hypergraphs or however you want to approach it, they're getting at something much more intricate than this, which is just a number. But because of that, it's sort of, in some ways, it doesn't tell you quite as much, but it tells you something you might not have thought to ask. I don't know of any direct connections. There's some connection in holographic states in three dimensions. There's this conjecture that this is actually equal to the logarithmic negativity, which is another multipartite entanglement measure. So at least in holography, there's some connection, but I don't think that that connection holds for non-holographic quantum systems.
Thank you.
So I also have a very naive question, perhaps. So I was wondering, like, just in terms of broad context, so I understand there is a program trying to understand how space-time metrics emerge from like some kind of quantum correlations. So what does like the root RT formula give you towards that in terms of these bipartite entanglement, and what does it not? So that you go to these like tripartite entanglements, if you could say some, like giving me like a high-level overview, maybe a few words, that would be really helpful.
Yeah, so the main intuition from this comes from a paper by Mark van Ramstonk from 10 or so years ago called Building Up Space-Time with Entanglement. And the idea is, well, let's look back at our very first picture. So this quantum extremal surface is the minimal bulk surface that divides A from B, right? So you imagine that if you were to shrink the entanglement entropy, then that surface would have to shrink. And if you shrunk the entanglement entropy all the way to zero, then these two regions would become disconnected from one another, right? So that's sort of the broad intuition for what bipartite entanglement tells you about emergence. It tells you about the existence of connections, right? It tells you about the existence of connections between sort of two asymptotic regions, but it tells you very little about the fine details of those connections, right? It tells you very little about, you know, sort of how much of the connection between A and B is concentrated on the left half of the space-time and how much on the right half of the space-time and things like that. And so, for example, you know, it's never going to be able to tell you very much. You know, it tells you about where these quantum extremal surfaces come from, but heuristically, we like to say, you know, it doesn't tell you very much about intersections of those surfaces, or it doesn't tell you much about objects that aren't co-dimension two, for example, the entanglement entropy, or sorry, the endpoints that I've been talking about this whole talk, those are could have mentioned three objects, right? So the hope is that, I mean, one hope of studying multipartite entanglement is to understand those things better. But I think actually in some way, what studying these questions really helps us do is it helps us nail down the question. You know, the question of how spacetime emerges from entanglement is like, it's a really good heuristic with a lot of good sort of interesting partial results. But, you know, there's gotta be something like very clean and beautiful and precise to say about it. And I think we don't quite know what the exact perfect question is. And part of the reason I think it's good to explore these things is to help find the right question.
Thanks. So maybe an equally vague follow-up question. So how much of this could, say, emerge from classical correlations, or would it not at all? Like, is there any way
this is sort of an interesting question, and I think like hard to get at. Mm-hmm. One fact is that holographic states, classical holographic states, satisfy this inequality called monogamy of mutual information, which is supposed to indicate that in holographic states, quantum correlations dominate over classical ones. That's true of states that satisfy the monogamy of mutual information. So that's sort of one partial answer, is that in holographic states, because they satisfy this certain, you know, multi-party inequality, it seems like quantum correlations are the most important thing. There's more stuff you could say about it. For example, there is a bulk spacetime connection, right? Meaning that I could throw in a particle from side A and get to side B, right? And you should think about that as being like, from the boundary perspective, it's sort of like quantum teleportation. You know, I start with a qubit on one side and I end up with a qubit on the other side. And we know that you can't do quantum teleportation with classically correlated states. You need quantum entanglement. So this really does seem to be an effect of a quantum effect more than a classical one.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, do we have any other questions? Okay, if not, let's all thank John for, again, for a really nice talk.